It's an interview with Widener at Marshall Space Flight Center.
Okay, we're on.
We want to talk to you, I guess, for a little bit, maybe about propulsion and propulsion systems and the development of liquid hydrogen technology.
That's it. Pick up as you talk, as slowly as you do.
Yeah.
You made in...
The wonders of modern technology.
Yeah, made in Japan.
Okay. Made in Holland.
Oh, yeah. Now, then it is good. Okay, now, back. Let's be serious about it.
Okay. Propulsion and liquid hydrogen technology. And were you involved in, for example, some of the early business with Centaur and the RL-10 engines and the problems with the production, supply, and storage of LH2, its use in near-Earth environment?
The latter part, I personally had no involvement. Of course, we all have, due to our you might say positions and people working for you. There are people which have concerned themselves with storage and losses and so on. But personally, I'm not too knowledgeable about that. Now, as far as the IL-10 engine is concerned, as you probably know, this was started under Air Force leadership, and I think at one time then a decision was made that this project was to be turned over to NASA, and Marshall was the selected place to do this. Yes, we were involved very deeply in this. At that time, I was in the what is now the Astronautics Laboratory, or now Organizational Propulsion and Vehicle Engineering, PNVE, I think was the name. And I was the deputy of the laboratory at that time, and was at the same time director of propulsion for the center. So I was deeply involved in that part. I know that according to early plans, the engine let me put it this way, they were rather optimistic and ambitious plans to get this engine into production, and they had some fantastic schedules, how almost like pretzels versus time these should come out for all sorts of NASA flight purposes. I think at that time one was still hopeful that all these Mars and Ranger missions and lunar missions, the unmanned ones, that they would all fly much, much faster and much earlier than originally planned. Now, this was, of course, for many reasons not the case, like availability of payloads and all these things are much costlier maybe than the early days people were thinking and expecting, so money didn't go as far as it did. Also, NASA budget did not keep growing. Obviously, the lunar program was more expensive, more demanding than it was. So these things were suffering in a way from that. But coming back to the engine, also the engine, I think, was not quite as ready as one was hoping then. There was more development work to be done. And I think our people here worked very closely with Pratt & Whitney during this period, where this was a Marshall assigned responsibility. And I think the engine was brought to a maturity which finally gave it a very fine flight record, for instance, on the early Saturn, the S4 stage, the upper stages. It has done marvelously well in, 10 flights or so. Not quite 10, I think the first ones didn't have upper stages, but at least five or six flights, or something like that. It has done very well. Also in the Centaur, I will say the engine has done well, and some of the early Centaur difficulties, one might not trace back to propulsion per se, but to all sorts of peripheral kind of problems which an engine sees in a problem. I believe this IL-10 is a jewel of an engine, and was really the first one, as you know, to have hydrogen as one of the propellants, as a fuel. And I think Pratt & Whitney has, by and large, done an excellent job in getting this engine going. And we had good working relations between our technologists and engineers here on the government side, to work together with the Pratt & Whitney people in seeing the problems through and getting the engine to the status it finally assumed, while the whole thing was was still with Marshall. It was later on turned over to others, as you probably know.
It was given to Lewis.
It was given to the Lewis. And the reason...
Didn't our liquid hydrogen technology kind of start with Lewis anyway?
Well, maybe this is certainly true. And the reason for that is very, very simple. If you look at the family of NASA centers, and each and every center plays a certain typical role. Now, Lewis being one of the family of research centers together with Langley, Ames, and places like that, they are supposed to work the basic technologies by charter. And one of the prime thing, if not the prime thing for Lewis, of course, is propulsion. And they have done a lot of work by either a contract outside or by in-house work to lay the groundwork within NASA for this technology. And there are quite a number of remarkable things which Lewis people worked out, which have been accepted and taken over into the R10 program, like the injector, for instance. The injector is something which the Lewis people basically developed, which was introduced into the R10 engine, and later on the J2 engine had the same injector. So it's only natural that the bits and pieces of technology work had to come out of Lewis at a time when the other part of NASA, namely the development centers like ours, were ready to utilize those. So there is this natural phasing kind of thing, where the early work, which in areas which have promise for the future, have to be carried by those fellows. And people like ours are really system center, where all these bits and pieces, when they become available and ready and can be realized in real flight hardware or flight applications, they take over, and our place is really in this latter part of the NASA family. We are a development center, a system center. This is our strength. We are not so much the technology area. Now, one cannot draw a very hard line between a research center and a development center. There are certain overlap areas, I think. There, if you want to have excellent people to participate and do development, you have to allow them a certain part of early works and of genuine and original work of their own. So it's in this overlap area where our discipline groups are allowed to do a certain part of work, which is closer, of course, to the systems application thing. And what you say, the storage of hydrogen in space thing, is one of those areas where people around Charlie Wood and so on, Hans Paul's group, have been active over the many years. So in that sense, applying now or providing for hydrogen in space applications, since now we had an engine or a means of using it to our advantage, these are things which then a systems and development group like ours has to concern itself with. So this was a very, very heavy experience. And the reason why the engine finally had to be, or the engine and the whole vehicle, Centaur vehicle, had to be turned over to another center like Lewis was simply this, that the Saturn program seemed to take on proportions of involvement and demands on our people that we just didn't feel we had the capacity of giving the Saturn the attention which we felt it deserved, and doing these things at the same time. Now, looking back with hindsight, I think one can say there's no reason why we couldn't have done this, but be this as it may, that was a decision, therefore, at this time that we told NASA we cannot do this anymore, and the decision wasn't made at the NASA top level that, therefore, this responsibility should be turned over to another center.
Was there a period when von Braun was not happy with liquid hydrogen propulsion in general?
I'm not aware of any such unhappiness. As a matter of fact, I'm sure that this is a story. I have been all these years very, very close to Werner, and certainly in the propulsion area, and he would be the last one to not be ready to pick up what is ready and to the advantage of vehicles and capabilities. No, not at all. If my recollection is right, there was I think under Abe Silverstein, NASA set up some sort of a review team in the early Saturn or immediately pre-Saturn days, where they were where they kind of reviewing, maybe the question was very simple, what kind of propellants and therefore what kind of engines and stages should a Saturn or a lunar vehicle have RV ready for? They should we stay with the old JP type of propellants, or are we ready with our technology and the basis of knowledge to commit ourselves and the country to these upper stages? And I think they did a hard look, and I don't know whether Werner as a person was even a member of this group, but I couldn't say that with certainty. But I know that that they came out with a recommendation, yes, we are ready for hydrogen, and by all means, this was a correct decision, and had to my recollection the wholehearted support of this, and yes. There were some efforts going at that time on a what-if basis. What would we do if this would not be the case? They were looking into Titan hardware. Could one either cluster or build up something like that? What would it take to do this? This would have made for awkward type of vehicles, which would not have ever had the capability and capacity what the Saturn finally had, the Saturn V especially. So I would say, there's nothing to this to this question.
No, I heard that story.
Huh?
I somewhere I came up with that story.
Well, it might be all of these things. This makes good reading. The conflict somewhere.
We found many things like that.
Exaggerated sales papers.
Can you make some comments about the development of the RL-10 Centaur systems that led to the development of the S4 and S4B and even the S2 systems? Were there things that were useful on the Centaur and J2 that you were able to apply in the other ones?
These things useful on the Centaur and the J2? No, you mean useful on the Centaur, which could be translated into J2?
Besides the injector, for example.
You mean the engine in the engine area, propulsion area?
The engine area. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would expect that all government funded kind of things like a development, and here we are talking about the Centaur development by way of reports and so on, the difficulties and the solutions for those difficulties are common knowledge, so they become common knowledge, and these other companies like Rocketdyne or Aerojet, they of course were using these things for their own laying out of the engines and designing these things properly. But also NASA, of course, was sponsoring bits of technology work, and I think Rondell Tischler, I don't know whether you heard his name. At that time, he used to be with the manned spaceflight family for propulsion. NASA was formed, he was originally a Lewis man, like George Lowe and many others. When Abe Silverstein was called, I'm digressing a little bit by the question if that's of interest. And Abe was called up to Washington in the early days of NASA. I think Abe did one great thing, among others, when he came to Washington, he realized that a good transfusion of excellent people into this new headquarters thing was something to help the agency to get going, and he may be personally convinced and twisted arms of X number of his more senior and better Lewis people, which had grown up in the old NECA Lewis environment where he was the center director. He convinced them to go with him to headquarters in order to form a basis from which an agency like this one operate, and quite a number of people like those which I mentioned and many others at that time went to headquarters and stayed there. So Dale Tischler was one of those fellows, and his background then is specifically propulsion. He is one of the senior fellows, and later engine efforts like the F1 engine, the J2 engine, all this was started, even though the assignment was given to Marshall, but he was our headquarters counterpart. For all these things, as you know, there is one headquarters office or headquarters guy or whatever it is, an organization and headquarters responsible.
Was Milton Rosen over him? Or was it just a separate office?
Well, I think Milt Rosen, you might say maybe in the pecking order was over him. I believe if my recollection is right, the first guy, Mr. Man Spaceflight, who in the generation of subsequent guys as today Dale Myers, was General Ostrander. Ostrander was the first Mr. Man Spaceflight, and his idea was that there should be in NASA a launch vehicle center. Had picked Marshall for that, from the scout all the way up to whatever it is, should be in one center, and that should be us. And in that process, incidentally, the center was ours, since we were to be that center. But as I say, we felt we couldn't do justice to all that and still do the Saturn and our lunar commitment. So then this is where this scheme started to break apart. The next one was Holmes. And Milt Rosen was, I think, kind of a second man to Holmes, to Austin. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, he was at that level. And then in one of these interims periods, Milt Rosen was running the shop and therefore was above Bell Tischler and all these other fellows. Yes, he was for a while in his function, maybe as deputy or so, was tending the shop while the new man was not selected yet. So then, and I would guess that he was above. And especially engine was Dale Tischler's assignment in the Manned Space Lab family. And there was a lot of engine effort to be started, like the J2. The IR-10 was with us at this time. Then the H-1 engine was with us at that time. So you see there was a sizable commitment and a sizable dollar volume, which in this area would come via Huntsville, and Dale Tischler was the program director, you might say, for that particular section and segment of Washington. Now, Dell, in later years, when these engines were kind of a going concern, he moved away from the manned spaceflight family and went back to the technology ORT. And has been up to maybe a year or two ago, has been Mr. Propulsion in the technology area for many years and has guided NASA's overall preparatory efforts. Until maybe 2 years ago, he then got another assignment, like being Mr. Shuttle Technology, a very broad assignment. Mm-hmm. Now we lost ourselves. What was the question? You were asking, did technology from the R10 find its way. So what I was kind of saying, out of these Dale Tischler kind of things, there were also technology efforts which went into the centers, and these were efforts which went to all eligible contractors and were also partly hydrogen technology oriented.
Was he the broker of these technologies? Did he get things from companies and pass them on to the centers and get studies from the centers and pass them on to the contractors?
No, I think this is to narrow a connotation. Look at it this way. There must be a guy in headquarters who says I'm responsible for laying the groundwork for tomorrow, and I believe that such and such things are ready to be done and should be done in view of of NASA's broad objectives. And then this is a guy who has to help to go forward to Congress and defend this and say, Mr. Congress, in hearings. NASA efforts are being discussed for the next fiscal year, then he's saying, look, for such and such a reason, I believe such and such things should be done, and it would cost that much money, and has to try to convince the congressional members, at least in this committee, that this is justified and just and right. And let's assume this is accepted, then, and X million dollars for such broad efforts are being accepted, not a task by task thing, but on an objective basis. And he would now be the one who has, together with the center, argue with the center and break this down into the next level of objectives and maybe finally into tasks. And these tasks would then be very, very specific to work a better impeller or a better inducer on a pump, or know something about bearings, hydrogen lubricated, or about a better injector or cooling heat transfer questions, or whatever it is. Things of identifiable tasks like that. And then one would be basically go out on a competitive basis to industry and say, here is this task we want to be done, and it's about these things we expect to come out on it, and it's a 1 year or 2 year kind of effort, and we are prepared to pay that much money for it, which is a level of effort. And then they come forward and offer what they would be thinking of doing, and this is how they are determined. Now, industry, of course, is involved in planting ideas and talking to all sorts of guys like us, like the Tischlers, or anybody who wants to hear it and where they think he has some influence on these matters somewhere. They'll go and talk and say, look, what I know or what I think, I have a good idea. For such and such reasons, I believe it would be useful for NASA and applications, since it has such and such advantages. So they come forward and tell this story, and of course they, in so doing, plant ideas that something is ready to be done. And there is this process, no doubt, taking place, but it's intermixed with ideas of our people and so on, and do believe their story. Are they really ready, and are we really ready to do things? Is there an application? But it's a whole family of guys which are communicating and talking to each other, and out of this come things which are ready and therefore should be picked up and be done. The J2 engine really was born about the time when it seemed to be. Maybe we start one notch earlier after this Sputnik kind of shock, which the country and the entire aerospace family felt. There was a feel, one thing we can do immediately before we know what else we do, we need engines with larger thrusts, since our 3.5 pounds or so in orbit, this was something which wouldn't look well in the eyes of the rest of the world compared with statements of what the Russians were doing, so many thousand pounds. They had a dog up there, they did this and they did that. So one thing became obvious, that we needed something with more thrust, larger engines. And I believe, as I see it, the reason why this country didn't at that time do or hadn't done work in larger engines was simply this, since all these propulsion means, the engines, are something designed for defense purposes. And maybe you could say the payloads, hydrogen bombs and so on, this country had advanced to a point that in a much smaller weight they could pack, I don't know how much energy, and therefore they could get away with much smaller vehicles, whereas the Russians, they might not have had this advancement to that level of sophistication and payload concern, so they needed much cruder, much larger vehicles, much larger engines, which at the point when our space flight became our interest was an advantage, and they milked this advantage to the ultimate. So we were not ready with large thrust engines, and that was the point where it was said, let's build larger engines. So the F1, 1.5 million pound of thrust, something unheard of. We were in the 200, 250, or maybe even a little less, 165, or whatever these figures for the Atlas, for the Jupiter, for the Thor. This class of engines was all the country had at this time. So here we made a big step towards the $1.5 million by the factor of 10. Or hydrogen from the, what was it, 15,000 of the IR-10 to 150,000, 200,000 for the J2 at that time. So this was an unheard of step, which of course was right, since if you want to have man in space or large payload into space, we needed these engines. So this was one thing where one didn't have to ask what project or what for, or so it was very obvious that this factor of 10 or so was just needed. So during these early space flight days, so right after Sputnik, the country was ready to do this. And as a matter of fact, these engines were started and formulated at a time when Kennedy's appeal, let's go to the moon, was not really expressed, and the thing was not set yet. So it all came in handy when indeed these projects were formulated and these efforts were going at this time. Now, the sizing was such that by the method of clustering, there was a lot of flexibility to take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or whatever number of engines and adapt it to the size of the final vehicle and the need. An exciting period. Quite different then than it is today. I know I was on the source evaluation board on the SEB, which was a very interesting job at that time. I was on a similar board just a few weeks ago on this new engine. Somebody gave me that now, hints of scandal. So this is today's world. Everybody is competing for the few dollars which every so often come by. At this time there was a big space program maybe coming, so if you don't win this one, then we win the next one. But today there's only one to be won, and you can make one guy happy and there will be X number of unhappy people. So it's a different game these days. I don't know whether I'm telling you something which is useful for your purposes or...
Well, I think so. I think one of the things that we are interested in is seeing the Saturn program as a rather deliberate series of steps of building block concept. And as far as engines were concerned, we were interested in technology that was developed in one system that was applicable to another system, and how you went from there. And so that's why I was interested in what you would have to say maybe about the RL-10 leading to the J-2 in that respect.
All the things which were done in the RL-10 and were done in the CENTAUR and the stage application, they were no doubt useful to us and to the designer, since it gives you the confidence that indeed these things can be mastered and can be used in a large scale in a field. Hydrogen being a rather novel kind of liquid in this application at least, and can one master and handle this in the field? Is it safe? Will the thing not burn up? Will we be able to master this? The leaks, hydrogen, you do not see it. If it burns, you do not see it somewhere. And of course, you are playing with very dangerous things in there. Can we insulate it, these large tanks? Can we pump it well and so on? Do we know enough about the materials at these low temperatures, about welding, how does material behave, how do welding seams behave in this environment? The CENTAUR had used one class of material, glass, hard kind of stainless steel. Now we needed to go to other materials, so like aluminum and so on. There was a lot to be learned, and the work which was stimulated and done then in the CENTAUR and in the engine no doubt had a very healthy effect on our confidence and readiness to go the hydrogen route in the Saturn engine. Obviously, we took even the engine, the RL-10, and clustered it by way of, what was it, 6 or so?
Six
in the S4B, since that was the most readily available solution.
Would you like to comment on the overall design philosophy? Roger mentioned the building block approach and off-the-shelf hardware, the whole seeming conservative nature of the design to fit within the required schedule and finances available.
Well, I think you said a word like conservative, and maybe Marshall is a conservative outfit as far as design philosophy is concerned.
Do you feel that way?
Well, I think we have a healthy conservatism, and I don't say this in a negative sense.
No, I'm
you
not
can,
saying that. Yeah.
You can overdo things very much by being daring, by going to the very close to the limits and so on. But then there's a question of how well do you really know the conditions in a design? Can you describe it well so that your analysis holds and so on? I think we rather would like to